often it feels like the system is designed against you rather than to enable you.
Other systems that we have in place today fit for optimum engagement.
What we're kind of missing at the moment is a reimagining of education.
Dr. Luke Roberts is at the forefront of systems thinking and sustainable innovation, reshaping how organizations approach change and conflict. He is empowering leaders across sectors to unlock creativity and drive systemic transformation through the principles of complexity theory.
You just become another cog in the wheel and you become like a product of society.
What is it that, you know, motivates someone? What is it that gets them excited? What gets them passionate? What gets them creative?
People aren't really tapping into what their true talents are and passions are.
So what is it that you may need in the future isn't a qualification, but you need. I think where it will play out most actually isn't now, but when Gen Z becomes parents, and they're going to have very different demands on what they think schooling should be and how schooling can support their children. How does education help me find a purpose rather than simply going, AI will be part of future systems in the workplace. So we need to have.
Hey everyone, I'm Sina Hagihat and welcome to First Serve. The path to live a fulfilled and abundant life is to learn, grow and serve. And that is what this podcast is all about. We'll have guests on the show who are utilizing their skills to make a positive impact to our world. Together we can gain a lot of insights, expand our knowledge and apply our learnings to serve others to the best of our abilities. Welcome to the First Serve podcast. This is the first episode of a three-part series. In this episode, we'll talk about the education system. Is it designed against us, or can it be designed to enable us to thrive? What role will AI play in the future workplace, and what do Gen Zs want to make an impact in this world? Today's guest is going to go through all of those questions with us. He has a PhD and a Master's in Educational Research from Cambridge University, an MBA and a degree in politics and law. He is the founder and CEO at Resolve Consultants and is also the author of the book Leading Schools and Sustaining Innovation. Welcome to the First Serve podcast, Dr. Luke Roberts.
Thank you very much for having me.
So you clearly have a passion for education with all of your achievements. So I just want to dive into, you know, how you came about pursuing a career and education in this space. So where did it all stem from?
Oh, that's a big question. I think for me, one of the things is that I'm always curious. So my curiosity kind of leads me to want to explore, want to understand things. And so I think originally when I was studying law, I was also working in a evaluation company and we were looking at restorative justice. So I had two parallel ways of understanding justice. So the legal system and a community-based model of justice. And for me, I kind of fell out of love with the legal process because I saw when people came together to talk about their issues, it wasn't a win-lose scenario. It was much more, how can we win together? So I was really attracted to those kinds of ideas. And so for me, part of following on from that in terms of thinking through how do we go about resolving conflict? How do we go about engaging with conflict in healthy ways? First of all, you kind of look at the individual and then you look at the relationship. And then you start to think about, well, what are the situations in which conflict occurs? And then ultimately you start to think about, well, what are the systems that generate those situations? So the kind of academic journey was trying to work out what's the theories and evidence that support the change I'd like to see in the world, basically.
Yeah. And how is that related to like your upbringing or your childhood? Is that something that, because obviously you have passion in this space. And I think when people really spend their like time and energy on a certain topic is because they really want to make an impact and it's affected their lives in a particular way. So you want to make a difference.
Ooh, that is a good question. I think I always struggled in education, in formal education. So even though I've done these things, yeah, it was never easy for me. And I was only diagnosed with dyslexia kind of in my late 30s. And so that was part of the answer to why I struggled so much, because my brain is neurodiverse and the education system caters for like neurotypical people. So there was always this feeling of not quite getting it, but also really wanting to understand things at the same time. So I think from that perspective, that's one of the reasons I'm so passionate about education. Education and learning, like how do we learn? How do we learn as individuals and how do we learn as communities? But I think the second part for me was also around when you see inequality in systems like educational inequality and also social inequality, how can education or how can education be routes to change? And so what are the pathways that are created for young people to be able to thrive, to be able to be their best? And often it feels like the system is designed against you rather than to enable you. So you might have like a brilliant teacher, but a brilliant teacher in a system that isn't particularly supportive means you kind of latch onto them even more. But the challenge is, how do we make sure that, for me particularly, how do we make sure that all young people can thrive? And often the pathways that you have to create aren't easy for other people to follow. And it's about how do we make sure that educational equity starts to happen.
Yeah. And tell me more about your PhD. What was it on? And what were your key learnings from that?
I think so. When I did my MBA, I was kind of towards the end of my MBA, I started to read about systems. And I was like, there's something in that that is really fascinating. And I remember listening to a podcast by Russell Acuff. And he said this brilliant thing. He was like, MBAs give you like the ability to talk on with authority on things you don't know anything about. They give you a language that not many people understand, and they might lead to a management job. He was quite a maverick. And for me, listening to him talk, he was talking about systems. And I thought there's something in what he's saying that's really attractive, but also something that counters some of the stuff that I was reading at the time. So when I did my second master's in educational research, it was really looking at the methodologies and the processes by which you could start to understand what I thought at the time was like a particular type of systems change. And again, I was really fortunate. I had a conversation with a professor who kind of said, like, you're interested in like whole organizational change, whole school change, but what do you actually think you're trying to change? And so I'd used the language, but never understood the substance of the change that I was after, because I thought, well, it's really obvious. We want to change things for the better. And he was like, that's not always the case. So the PhD kind of came about because even at the end of that master's, I still hadn't got the answer to the question, which was, what is it we're trying to change? And if we're trying to change it, how do we sustain that change? And so complexity theory at the time, I was really starting to get into, but it was very much like, you know, you build a simulation, you then like test your simulation against real world events. And I kind of thought about it from a different perspective, which was, how do we look at real world events and then say, what's the complexity in that? And particularly in social systems. So the PhD started to evolve into an understanding of, well, what does it take in social systems to really sustain innovation in a way that isn't just a kind of flash in the pan, short term thing that is really catchy one year and then fades out the next. And I think that's where I started to get really excited in terms of, okay, I can see how the PhD isn't just a thing that I want to understand. I can see benefits to bigger kind of ideas around change, school improvement, quality assurance. There's a bit of a critique of all of that that comes through in my PhD.
Yeah. And let's just maybe take a step back and for our listeners, just explain, like, what is a system? Because some of our listeners might be thinking, what does he mean by a system? So in layman's term, can you explain what a system comprises of?
At its simplest, we're saying that a system is basically interdependent parts. So we're not interested in the parts themselves, but how the parts work together. So really good example is like a beehive, for example. The hive interacts in a way that isn't dependent on any particular bee, for example. And similarly, when we think about something like, and that would be a complex system, whereas a more simple system is a bike and a rider. You only get transport when the bike and the rider interconnect. Otherwise, it's just a bike and a person. And so what we're always looking for is, what is the connection between things? And that tells you that a system is starting to emerge or that a system is in play. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. And then what's complexity theory?
So, that's a huge question. So I can't do that justice in one go. But in essence, for me, complexity theory is about understanding interconnection, interdependency within a system that has it has a behavior. And so when we're looking at complexity theory, what we're really interested in is complex adaptive systems. So systems that are able to change either internally or in response to a stimulus. So if you think about, like, let's take a school, for example. A school might have, you know, been seen as quite a simple system. Children go in the village school, and then they come out and they're educated. But over time, because let's say there's urbanization, there's a buildup around the community, the school has to adapt to new needs of that community. And in doing so, it changes its interactions and it changes its interdependency. And so you can see there with a complex system, there's much more of a dynamic interplay that happens as opposed to a mechanistic system or a simple system.
Yeah. And then what led you to write your book?
I think to some extent, I was really lucky that my supervisor was really passionate about my research and said, I think you've got some really powerful ideas that need to be shared with the world. And then the publisher said, great, way too academic. So they kind of wrote to a couple of people that I knew and said, like, you know, what would make this more accessible? And people said, well, can you show how it gets applied? You know, give us application, not just here's the theory, but give us examples of when we could use this in like a leadership meeting or looking at a particular problem. So I wrote it with the intention of saying, here's, you know, a lot of this language can feel quite overwhelming, but when you actually get to see an application, it starts to have its logic that most people gravitate towards quite quickly, I think.
Yeah. And what were like some of the key learnings from the book? Or one of the things that is quite close to my heart is, you know, how can we like improve student engagement? Are the systems that we have in place today fit for optimum engagement? Because sometimes it's all about theory and not enough practice. It's about consuming the information, not really applying it. Yeah, can you discuss that theory? You mentioned in your book, the gap between theory and practice. What can be done to improve that gap?
So I think one of the things is, in terms of theory is great, and there is a practical aspect of theory. The bit that bridges, which I think you're asking after, is how do we make sure that people are heard? So like, I might have a brilliant theory of increasing student attendance, for example, but that theory then needs to be not just me going, right, I'm going to deliver a project that improves student attendance, but what is stopping students from attending? What is happening for teachers, for example, that is making it challenging to get students to engage with their learning? How do parents engage with the school? What's the reputation of the school? So can you see we start to unravel what looks like quite a simple solution into, right, what are the bridges? What are the ways in which people perceive the challenge? Because they'll perceive it differently. So the theory of trying to change school attendance and increase, for example, a sense of community and identity that I belong here isn't dependent on theory plus intervention. It's much more dependent, I would argue, on what are the voices in the system? How are those voices heard? How do they feel they have agency, i.e. the ability to take action themselves? And then how does that link back to the change in the system you'd like to make? Because one of the biggest dangers is often people go like, I've got a great theory, I'll go test it against something, and they don't see unintended consequences. So we could say, right, okay, if we want to improve attendance, let's get, I don't know, attendance officers to go around on the first day of school to make sure students are there. But if they never go around the second or the third day, everyone knows, right, I just have to be there for the first day. And then attention shifts. And so then I can stop showing up on the second and the third day. So you create an unintended consequence with the intervention if you don't understand your system.
Yeah. And then in terms of the curriculum, I have a feeling that you just become another cog in the wheel and you become like a product of society. Like, you're in this production line, like everyone studies the same thing. You leave school and you either start working or you move on to higher education. And I feel sometimes that tailored education is lost, or people aren't really tapping into what their true talents are and passions are. Is there anything that can be done there as well?
Well, I think so. We have a massive challenge with education systems across the world, which a lot of them have been built on a production line model. So ultimately, we're going to train people in one of two ways. Either you're going to be a worker for a production line somewhere, or you're going to be a manager. And so the danger now is that when we look at the way in which work is changing and the ways in which people now have to access jobs, that model of the production line is so out of date. And yet we're still clinging on to it as if we can tweak it or change it. And that's going to make a difference. Whereas what we're kind of missing at the moment is a reimagining of education. So exactly your point, what is it that, you know, motivates someone? What is it that gets them excited? What gets them passionate? What gets them creative? And then where are the jobs that are going to be for that set of, that combination of skills and passions? And I think one of the things that's really hard at the moment is we don't know, for example, how things like AI is going to change the jobs market. So, but the lag between preparing children for jobs that don't exist is crazy because, you know, it's a bit like when they first introduced calculators, everyone's like, children are going to be, you know, dumber because they can't do the math. Whereas actually it's how do I use that tool in a way that helps me improve what I want to do? And at the moment, we're not using some of these big tools that are there in the workplace, that are changing the workplace in education. And again, that goes back to the reimagining point. So what is it that you may need in the future isn't a qualification, but you need capabilities and skill sets. Mm-hmm. And that's what we should be thinking about a lot more, because I can adapt my capability based on my skills. Whereas this qualification then says, I know this knowledge, but that knowledge may have changed dramatically because someone can now ask an AI system for that. But what they can't do, an AI system can't do, is creatively explore your situation in your system to be able to make that difference.
Yeah, that makes sense. Because when I think about what I studied at uni and what I use in the workplace, like things get out of date so quickly with the advancements in technology. So I think it's more about learning on the job and having the skill sets rather than memorizing a certain curriculum because it may not be relevant in a few years.
Exactly. There's your skill and then there's the skills you need to learn. And it's that second tier of skills that is often overlooked because everything is around, well, what's the content you need to understand or what do you need to memorize to repeat back in an exam? Rather than what are the skills you need to remember and then apply. Yeah. And so I think, again, this is where there is this risk of the lag, which is, you know, in the production line model, you needed to know just enough to be able to read the instructions to pull the lever to change the widget. Mm-hmm. Whereas now in this kind of era, you need to be able to memorize a whole series of skills and processes to be able to apply them to unique situations. And that's where your creativity comes in. So I think, again, it's almost like what's the meta skills of education that need to be articulated much more strongly. And yet we still value the qualification as opposed to what is this person able to do and what could they do with the right support? So what's the learning that comes after school? And that's very rarely talked about as well.
Because even in my own situations when I'm hiring, I tend to disregard some of the qualification parts and really focus on like the mindset of that person. Like, are they eager to learn? Do they have a strong work ethic over a list of qualifications? Because I think even in my own experience, I've been in so many different roles that I didn't have any experience in, but it's the attitude and your personality traits that allow you to put yourself in various roles and pick up the skills and experience as you go along. So I think that's a big misconception in society where we think, well, this person's got all these qualifications that, you know, for me, I think the mindset and personality like trumps that, and the attitude, because you can have someone that's really qualified on paper, but if they're not showing up or giving 100%, they're not going to add the most value.
Absolutely. And I think so, like my gran says, like enthusiasm is the biggest like sell. So she says, always be enthusiastic about things. And there's a truth in that, which is like, if someone's coming with an energy and an excitement, you'd want to explore further what they could do. I think part of the problem is that within education, because it's so focused on achieving the qualification and it's such a monotonous way in which we do it, you've got to read the book, repeat the book, apply the book to the question. Are we killing enthusiasm when we're doing that? Because by the end, you might be able to talk about, you know, whether it's chemistry, history, mathematics, but are we losing the enthusiasm that person has for learning by putting them through these qualification processes?
Yeah. And then in terms of your own learnings from your research, how has that changed the way you think about things in your day-to-day life? Do you see things slightly differently now that you have all this research into systems, because you start to focus on certain things and say, well, why is this like this? Or what's really happening here?
Yeah.
Like, has that changed your perspective in any way in terms of how you interact with people? Just the things you notice more that maybe were in your subconscious and now you're just like, oh, now I get why this is how it is.
Yeah, I think there's two parts to that for me, which is, like, I remember I gave a lecture a couple of years ago and I was talking about systems and some of the students were like, are you like Neo from the Matrix? All you see is like systems everywhere. And I was like, I guess I do, you know, like, and because you don't look at the thing, you look at what's it interconnected to. So when someone presents a problem, the problem is usually an indication of something in the system. So I don't tend to focus on the problem straight away and go, like, I want to know more instantly. So that leads you to being curious. And I think the second thing is when you're really thinking through systems change and helping people understand their systems, you need to slow things down, because everyone tends to come over and say, like, here's my problem right now. You need to change my problem right now. But what they forget is that there's been a history with that problem that has got you to that particular moment in time. So you need to be able to go, the present is important, but I need to know what's happened in that system over time to get us there. So I feel like often I'm kind of like slowing people down to go like, right, actually, can we see what's happening in terms of the patterns, the trends in your system, rather than just telling me here's today's problem. So like, I'll give a really interesting example. So years ago, I was working in the prisons and they were like, Luke, you know, we've got a problem with children putting snooker balls in socks and, you know, like whacking them over the head kind of thing. And I was like, okay. And so they're like, well, we need to ban socks. You know, like that's the answer, like ban socks and they'll stop doing it. And I was like, well, let's follow your logic. So if we ban socks and they start putting snooker balls in their underwear, are we going to ban underwear? If they do it with T-shirts, are we going to ban T-shirts? And what you can see happening is like everyone's going to walk around naked in the end, because it's such a simplistic response to a complex problem. And so the questions that were being missed was like, well, why do they need to hit each other over the head in the first place? What are the types of conflict that are occurring? Mm. How are we preventing those conflicts, or how are we engaging in a way that treats people with dignity and respect? But the urgency and the pressure to come up with a solution today means you can end up with some really crazy problems tomorrow because you think you've solved it and actually you've just made the system probably more detrimental to the people in it.
Yeah. Just really diving into the root cause in terms of what's causing that problem in the first place.
I think root cause sounds singular to me, whereas it's what's the interactions that are happening. So again, this is always like having to resist kind of going like, what's the singular, specific, thing we can do? And I think that's probably the biggest thing that I've learned exploring systems. Like, I have to constantly resist the urge of management theory to use that language when talking about systems.
Then I'm going to just quickly read a quote from your book, because okay, I want to know your opinion on this. So it said, sending a child to private boarding school in England, such as Eton, can cost up to £47,000 per year, whereas placing a child in a youth offending institution, a prison for under-18s in England and Wales, costs £119,000 per year per child in 2021. Just consider that for a moment. It costs over twice as much to send a child to a youth offending institution than to Eton, yet the consequences are diametrically opposed. What are your thoughts on that? Because when I read that, I was, yeah, quite astonished.
Well, I think it's kind of illustrating like the benefits we want to achieve. Like, for both of those two children, we want them to be valued members of society, yet we're spending almost twice as much, if not more, on a child who has got probably a whole set of traumatic issues, detrimental issues, possibly even learning difficulties. And yet we're not, for the amount of money we're spending, we are not achieving any of the results. So it tells you it's a systems issue by highlighting the financial issue. So what is the true cost in terms of where could we spend that money better? And so if we were to think about changing the prison system and changing the youth system in particular for the same amount of money, what else could we achieve? But the problem is we've now got so used to that level of system dominance, like children need to be in prison, that it then becomes very hard to imagine alternative models that can make such a difference. And so one of the things that the reason I highlighted that was because, well, if you could spend that money differently, would you spend it on more therapeutic support? Would you spend it on more money in the community? Would you spend it on kind of going, well, what are the career pathways for that child where they're at the moment? And so I think, you know, like the money is a way of highlighting how systems behave by what we choose to spend it on.
Yeah. In your book, you also mention schools applying component thinking instead of systems thinking. What do you mean by that?
So I think my experience has been, particularly in my kind of early years when I was working a lot more with schools in the UK, was like fads and fashions come up. So like, you know, we're going to do this thing around social emotional well-being, or we're going to do this thing around computing, or this thing, this activity, this intervention on mathematics. And what tends to happen is we focus on getting the activity up and running, and it doesn't have enough of a life cycle to really display how it interlinks with the rest of the school. So what you end up with is the risk of leaders wanting to look at kind of like fads and fashions and go, well, we'll get this in this year. Oh, that didn't work. We'll try something new next year. Oh, we need to do something for this particular group, like, you know, young people with dyslexia, for example. Oh, right, we've done that. Now let's move on to young people with autism. And what you see here is like this kind of constant grabbing of these component things that we think are going to change the system. But they're never given enough time to embed and interconnect with the rest of it. So the life cycle of that intervention might be a lot longer with a lot more benefit, but because of the component way in which leaders think sometimes, it means they don't think about, is this sustainable and what are the long-term benefits of the school community? And kind of part of my research at the time was saying most school change interventions have this life cycle of about 3 years, and then either they'll die off or they will be kind of co-opted into the system, so they'll be less than. And what I mean by that is that, like, yeah, we still do it, but then we add on a bit of this and we confuse it with something else. And it gets so kind of, what is it, messy and undefined that the very thing you thought you were trying to achieve gets lost. Like, all right, let's put it this way. Let's call it the Ribena effect. So when you start, you have like the high concentrated Ribena. And over time, little by little, by changing this, distorting that, you water it down. So you can still kind of go like, there is something in there that tastes like Ribena, but it doesn't have the same potency or effect as when it was concentrated. And that kind of watering down is the system co-opting things.
So I want to move on to Gen Z's values and the education system and how, you know, people have changed over time. So Gen Z's are now different to the other generation. So maybe they're not motivated by the same things. They may not be motivated by money as much, as more about purpose and passions. How do you see that shift between the generations and how the education system can adapt to these changes of values and motivations of the generations?
Well, I think firstly, in terms of like the passion and values, I think that's there in most people. It's not specific to Gen Z, but I think Gen Z are much more willing to stand by it rather than go, well, I can come back to that once I've got the mortgage, the holidays, the kids kind of thing. So there's much more of an authentic need to want to feel that you're making a difference in the world. And why shouldn't they? You know, like to some extent, like there have been massive causes in the past that people have rallied around. I think it just feels like there is so much changing in society that it's hard to get your bearing on like that, what we said earlier, that linear school, work, retire doesn't exist in the same way anymore. So you do need to think, right, what is the purpose and what is the passion that I want to have? And I think they're absolutely right to do that. I think the challenge that's going to happen for education isn't just that I've got the qualification. How does education help me follow my passions? How does education help me find a purpose rather than simply going, we've qualified you, now go find a job? That linear type of trajectory is falling apart in society. And in a good way, I think, because we're not all going to be factory workers, but we can be other things. And there are opportunities in terms of the workplace to do that. And there'll be opportunities in the future. But I think one of the things is that often this is met with a, oh, I'm not sure, you know, you're taking a risk, rather than what's the confidence we can give this generation. And I think where it will play out most actually isn't now, but when Gen Z becomes parents, and they're going to have very different demands on what they think schooling should be and how schooling can support their children as well, in terms of, well, where's the passion, where's the purpose in education, as opposed to this production line model that we talked about earlier. So I think change is on its way. Change always comes slower for some than others would like. But I think for Generation Z in particular, the promise of the good life has radically changed. And so what does it mean? How do you self-define? But also, how does systems embrace people who want passion, who want purpose? And I think what you're seeing is, like, what is it, in China, you have like this line flat trend where people are just saying, I'm not going to work, you know, the ridiculous hours, what is it, 7 days a week kind of thing, 365 days a year. Like, they're opting out. And in opting out, there's a risk for society that they don't see them as contributing. But then no one's having the question about, well, how do we motivate through passion and purpose, as opposed to you need to get a job, but no one tells you what job you should get.
Yeah. And we touched on AI a little bit earlier. What impact do you see that having in education system and also in the working world?
So I'm an optimist actually around a lot of this. So again, technology supports me with my thinking. So I use lots of different types of technology to help me write, for example. And so I started using some of the generative learning systems. And I was like, ah, it can help me generate text, which is like one of the slowest things. It takes me ages to just like write a sentence because I'm trying to get it right. Whereas like if it's there, I can then craft and shape that a lot quicker. So I think at the moment, there's like all of this kind of hesitancy and a fear around AI. And what's the counter narrative in terms of like, how does it benefit beyond like really great in your mobile phone, but how does it work in the workplace? How does it help people to be more creative, for example? A lot of that conversation is missed at the moment. And so for me, I think, you know, AI will be part of future systems in the workplace. So we need to have young people engaging with it a lot more earlier. We need to recognize what are some of the risks, absolutely, but also how can I use it to my, back to my calculator thing, how can I use it in a way that helps me achieve what I need to achieve, as opposed to, you know, like, oh, don't use it until you really absolutely need to. But by then you're having to learn something probably at the moment where someone's asking you to produce something for the very first time. So I think, you know, for this generation, Generation Z, there's a lot of change going on, but there's also a lot of risk averseness rather than how can we creatively use this? How can this enhance our lives? And I'd like to hear a bit more of that kind of storytelling in society.
Yeah, because I think there's this fear that AI will replace people and take away people's jobs. But my perspective is that AI won't get rid of people working. It's the people that know how to use AI will replace the people who don't know how to use AI. So it's more of a extra tool in your toolkit.
I think absolutely. I think there's something very English in this, which is, if you like, there was the Luddite movement where, you know, the craft weavers smashed up all the looms, you know, and the legacy of that is always to be skeptical of technology. And part of the reason we're skeptical of technology is twofold, because the craftsperson can create brilliant, unique things that might be one off. But we moved to a society that valued mass production. We're now moving back, I think, in some ways, like when you look at artisan bread or craft beer, like we're going back to like being able to craft things that feel uniquely yours is one part of it. But the second part of it is, because our educational system is also based off of that production line, it doesn't value adaptive learning. It says, here's the content you should know, and that should be in your head forevermore, as opposed to this will be really useful at one point, but you may need to learn in a different way at another. So again, this is where you get that resistance, I think, in terms of like, well, what do I need to change when these big things happen? And our educational system doesn't prepare people to learn.
I hope you enjoyed this episode and gained a lot of useful insights. In the next episode, we'll talk to Dr. Luke Roberts again, and we'll cover what makes a high-performing team, how to deal with change, along with navigating office politics. Trust me, you need to tune into this one. I'll see you there shortly.